thank you. I'm very glad for the opportunity to be here. I was thankful when Isaac contacted me about coming and doing this retreat. I do miss the fact that my family's not able to be here with me, but as I said, that means that I'm able to be free to interact with you guys as much as you would like. And so if I can be any kind of help to you in any way, I'd love to be able to do that. I've had the privilege of working with young adults at our church for the last 7 years, and I know you're dealing with a lot of different big decisions in life, and a lot of you are very busy. Most of you are probably both working and going to school, and there's a lot on your plate, and so I hope this can be an encouragement to you and a help to you as you think through some of the big questions of life and what really matters as we work through some of these things together. I try to provide some handouts for you guys just so that maybe it will help you to be able to follow along a little bit with what I'm doing. If you want to jot down some notes, you're welcome to do so with that as well. But hopefully then that can be something you can take away and help kind of jog your memory about some of the stuff we will talk about in our sessions together. Let me pray, and then we'll get into our first session here together this evening. Father, thank you for this time that we have to be here together, to get away from some of the normal aspects of life, and to be able to spend some extended time focusing in on your truth, and in particular the glory of the gospel in Jesus Christ. And I pray that you would help me to be clear and faithful to your word, that I would accurately reflect not only its truth, but its beauty, and that we, as we contemplate this reality, would be challenged by it and encouraged by it and motivated by it to share this truth with those that we know. I pray these things in your Son Jesus' name. Amen. I want to begin this evening by considering why Christianity. There are a lot of religions in the world today, and we are becoming more and more aware of these different religions. And you might have wondered this. You might have people who have interacted with you and asking, so why would you want to be a Christian then? Or even, maybe even, why should you even believe that God exists? Why would you want to believe something like this? And to begin to answer that question, I want to focus in on the gospel. You've heard the gospel. We've already mentioned the gospel. The word gospel, you know, means what?
Good news.
Good news. So what's so good about Christianity? Why is this news good news? And so I want to think a little bit tonight about what the good news about Christianity is. And to begin by asking, why is this world here? And according to Christianity, if you look at God's Word, the Bible, the very beginning of the Bible begins with what phrase? In the beginning, God. That God has existed for all eternity. And this God, we find out, is in a sense a community in himself. There's three persons and one God. And for eternity past, God has existed and enjoyed perfect love and perfect joy and perfect fellowship within that Godhead, Father, Son, and Spirit. And yet, perhaps we don't necessarily know all the reasons why, but I think it is fair to say in many ways, out of the overflow of that love and joy, God decided to create this world. And we find out about that in the beginning chapters of Genesis. We see this incredible power that God has, that he speaks and brings the world into existence. And the world that he brings into existence is a beautiful, perfect, good world. He gets to the end and looks at all his creation and says, this is very good. And yet, as we look at the world around us today, I think it's fair to say the world is still good in many ways, but there's something wrong. I study religions, and it's interesting. Every religious viewpoint says something's wrong with the world. Because everyone recognizes that. Now, they differ on what's wrong with the world. They differ on why things are wrong with the world. And as we look at the Bible, we find out what was wrong with the world. We begin to find that out in chapter 3 of Genesis. And in chapter 3, we find out something went wrong, and what went wrong is sin. That sin is the problem with the world. Sin is what is wrong with the world. And there's different ways that we could understand sin. Sometimes we talk about sin as missing the mark, that there's a target, and we didn't quite reach the target. Sometimes we talk about sin, and the Bible talks about sin as disobedience. Sometimes the Bible talks about sin as transgression, as going across the boundary. But I found for me, one of the ways that it's been helpful to kind of get at the heart of what sin is to recognize that sin is a failure to have God in his rightful place. That if you look at Genesis 3:5, we won't turn there this evening. But in Genesis 3:5, you'll find what's happening is you have Satan in the form of a serpent tempting Eve. And really what he's tempting Eve with is to remove God from being God and become her own God. Because throughout Genesis 1 and 2, there's one person who's always been saying things are good. And who is that person? God. That God's the one who gets to determine good and evil. And yet, Satan says to Eve, you can eat of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This tree that would say you can determine good and evil for yourself. Because when you do so, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. And that's the temptation that Adam and Eve face. And they decide, you know what? We don't want God to be God. We want to be our own God. And that's been at the heart of sin ever since. Which is why Jesus says, what's the greatest commandment? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. Every part of you is supposed to be directed toward God because that's what it means for him to be God. And yet that's what we fail to accomplish. That we don't have God in his rightful place. And so we could perhaps say it this way. That sin is basing our identity or seeing ourselves in some way other than God. Valuing something else and putting something else in the place that God deserves. And everyone does this. Everyone has something that we could say we kind of get our identity from that we view ourselves in light of. For some people, it could be athletic achievement. Some of you have probably seen the movie Rocky. Ever seen that movie? It's interesting. In one of the scenes, Adrian, who's basically the wet blanket in the movie, right? She's always telling Rocky he can't do it. And she says, why do you have to fight like this? And what does Rocky say? He says, I need to go the distance so that I know I'm not a bum. What he's saying is, I get my self-identity. I view myself in light of what I could accomplish in the ring. That's how I know I'm valuable. Because I can accomplish this thing. Now for others, it's not athletic achievement because you're like, I have no desire for anything athletic. But it might be for you, maybe a relationship. Some kind of maybe love. Or maybe friendship, or maybe it's your work, or maybe it's some kind of achievement, some kind of goal that you want to reach. Or maybe it's money or possessions. And we begin to view ourselves in light of these things. And the problem is, when we do that with anything other than God, it inevitably leads to a destruction or loss of ourself. and a loss of any real hope and joy. Because let's say you begin to center your life on a romantic partner. Or one day you get married and you begin to identify yourself in light of your husband or your wife. And in that situation, what inevitably begins to happen is you become very controlling, very jealous. And the moment that your spouse doesn't live up to your expectations, you begin to have conflict and you have fighting. And if they begin to struggle in some way, that's just overwhelming to you. Or perhaps instead, you eventually decide, I want to think of myself in light of my family. And there's an emphasis right now in our society on family values. And that's a good thing. But the problem is often we begin to think of our family as ultimate. And you have, maybe you've heard this before, you have the rise of helicopter parents. And there's this big idea right now in our society in which parents effectively try to live their lives through their children. And one of the ways you see this happening is you go to a Little League game and see how the parents are interacting on that sport. And you think, you know, a parent who, like, ends up getting in a fight with a coach or another parent in light of Little League, you're like, what's going on there? And the answer is, they are viewing their children as the key to their life. And it inevitably causes problems because children can't bear that kind of weight. It's crushing to them. And so then it becomes crushing to you. Now, for others, you might say, I don't care about my family. I have a certain career. I have a certain job path I want to go down. And as you begin to pursue this, you perhaps become a workaholic and your life is just wrapped up in your work, which means you tend to become a pretty shallow person. And you shut out all your friends and you shut out all your family, or perhaps lose your family in the process. And then what happens when you lose that job? Or you don't get that promotion that you were hoping for. And that's how so many people end up in depression and anxiety and all these kinds of issues that they face. Or perhaps you begin to pursue money or possessions and you begin to get eaten up by worrying about these things. Wondering if something's going to get lost, or if the stock market's going to crash, or you begin to even consider doing unethical things in order to maintain your lifestyle. You wonder sometimes, what's happening with these companies who, like, keep cooking the books? You know, one of the things that's happening? They're trying to maintain their lifestyle and the money that they've accrued, and they don't want to give it up. And so they're willing to do anything to get to that goal. And it's destructive. And maybe for you, you're just like, hey, I'm just here to have a good time. I just want to have fun. I want to be able to relax. I don't necessarily, I'm not trying to get a lot of money. I don't want to get a big job. I just want to be comfortable in life. And people who begin to think that way begin looking for ways to get highs. Sometimes it's drugs. Sometimes it's other things. And you begin to pursue those things more and more to escape the realities of life, because life often isn't very pleasurable and comfortable. And ends up eating away at you. And maybe you're someone who begins to identify yourself in light of the relationships you have. It's the friends you have on Facebook or the followers you have on Twitter. And these relationships, you think of yourself as, hey, I'm the person that everyone likes. And so when someone doesn't like you, or someone criticizes you, it begins to crush you. Because you want approval more than anything else. Or maybe you're someone who begins to pursue some kind of noble cause, some kind of goal. And we are, unfortunately, already in the middle of an election cycle. And you hear a lot of rhetoric right now about different causes and different issues. And there are people who devote themselves to these things. And what tends to happen is you begin to divide the world between people who are with you and people who are against you. And you begin to demonize those who are against you. And that's the kind of rhetoric we see more and more in our day. It's not just disagreement. It's as if here are the holy saints and here are the demons. And you begin to be controlled actually by your enemies. Because your goal is to stamp them out. And then for others, they begin to view their religion as what identifies them. And so they are trying to seek all the different rituals and standards their religion calls them to do. And if they're successful in that, then they have the ability to kind of look down on other people. And if they're not successful in that, then they're racked by guilt. And even if we get what we want, it doesn't lead to happiness. Think about people, let's just view money right now. When you ask people how much money is enough, what's the answer? A little bit more, right? You have people who, they have studies like this, right? People who make about $50,000 a year, well, how much would it take you to be asked? About 75. People make 75. How much? 100. Because you get there and then you realize this isn't enough. I remember a few years ago, I saw an interview with Tom Brady. Those of you who don't know him, he's a quarterback for the, most of you know him, right? He's a quarterback for the New England Patriots. And he's been very, very successful. Won multiple Super Bowls. And someone was asking him about that. They said, you know, that's just got to be like the pinnacle. And he's like, yeah, there's got to be something more. He said, I mean, it was great, but there's just got to be something more than that. Because you get to the pinnacle and you realize this wasn't what I was hoping for. And it leaves you crushed and disappointed. And not only does it hurt us, but it inevitably causes social issues. We've already touched on some of these. But it begins to harm those around you. Because you put unrealistic expectations on them. And then you also begin to view anyone who threatens what matters to you as your enemy. And someone to be put down. And that's what's happening more and more in our society. We talk about the culture wars. And really at the heart of the culture wars is our own disordered desires. That we want things. We want things to define us that weren't meant to define us. And the scriptures help us to realize that not only has it destroyed us and it destroyed society, but it actually has had cosmic consequences. In Genesis 3, shortly after Adam and Eve fell, God pointed out that because they were given the task of being God's co-rulers over the entire creation, that their disobedience to God had effects on the entire creation. He said, the earth is now cursed because of you. In Romans 8, Paul points out that the creation was subjected to frustration. That whereas God created the beautiful, perfect, and good world, which everything worked together in perfect harmony, we now have disease. We now have natural disasters. We now have the fact that we age and everyone dies. And this is all because of our sin. All because we have failed to put God in His rightful place. You see, this does not sound like good news. And that's not good news. So what is the good news? Well, the good news is that there is a solution. But we can't understand the solution until we understand what the problem is. Because if we don't understand the problem properly, we end up getting a wrong solution. And since the problem is our failure to put God in His rightful place, the solution is not just a change of behavior. The solution has to be a recentering of our lives. We've got to remove what's at the center of our life so that God can be back in His rightful place. And C.S. Lewis, some of you have heard him before. He was a world-renowned literary critic who also wrote a lot about Christianity. And he said something one time about this that I think was very helpful. He said, the almost impossibly hard thing is to hand over your whole self to Christ. But it's far easier than what we're all trying to do instead. For what we're trying to do is remain what we call ourselves, our personal happiness centered on money or pleasure or ambition, and hoping despite this to behave honestly and chastely and humbly. And that's exactly what Christ warned us you cannot do. That's what he said. If you try to save your life, what's going to happen? You're going to lose it. He said, if I'm a grass field, all the cutting will keep the grass less, but it won't produce wheat. If I want wheat, I must be plowed up and re-sown. Then I need to change the very nature of who I am. And our problem is, we don't want to do that. Instead, we tend to pursue one of two paths. And in doing that, we often don't realize just the nature of the sin inside of us. That we think if we just kind of try a little harder or do a little better, that we can change ourselves. We miserably fail to understand the nature of the wickedness inside of us. And to kind of understand a little better, I want to briefly think about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You may be familiar with that story, right? Dr. Jekyll ends up creating a potion that basically removes some of the inhibitions that he has and causes his own ego and his own self-interest to dominate. And when that happens, he becomes Mr. Hyde. And the first time he does this, he is just shocked at the evil that he's able to do. And so he decides, I can never let this happen again. And so he begins to reform his life. And so he's always trying to put away evil. And he begins to really focus on doing good and on doing charity. And in the story it says this. He's kind of, you know, he's narrating the story if you've ever read it before. I resolved in my future conduct to redeem the past. And I can say with honesty that my resolve was fruitful of some good. You know how earnestly in the last months of the last year I labored to relieve suffering. You know that much was done for others. But as I smiled, comparing myself with other men, comparing my act of goodwill with the lazy cruelty of their neglect, at that very moment of that vainglorious thought, a qualm came over me, a horrid nausea, and the most dreadful shuddering. I looked down. I was once more Edward Hyde. Because there's two kinds of self-centeredness. There's the self-centeredness and pride that says, I'm going to do what I want. I don't care what anyone else says. And that's what we tend to think of when we think about sin. But you realize there's another kind of self-centeredness and pride. There's a self-centeredness and pride that says, I can be my own Savior and Lord. And this is the attitude of the Pharisees. If you would, go to Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18 and verse 10. Here we have Jesus giving a parable of a Pharisee and a tax collector. It says, two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. Now, we need to understand who these people were. The Pharisees were the most religious people you could think of. I mean, if you think in our day of people like a Mother Teresa, right? Like someone who is committed to their religion, that's the Pharisees. And the tax collectors were like one of the most sinful people out there. Because they were flawed on at least two fronts. They were flawed, first of all, among the Jews, because they worked for the Romans, and the Romans were oppressing the Jews. So they were working for the enemy. But worse than that, they, while working for the enemy, took advantage of their fellow Jews in order to make themselves rich by cheating on the amount of taxes that they collected. And so these are people that, if you were a Jew, you're like, these are people who God hates, and the Pharisees are people that God loves. So these are the two people that the Jews would have thought of that way as they go up to the temple to pray. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I can get. That I'm someone who, I've overcome my self-centeredness and pride. I'm not evil like others. But the tax collector, standing far off, will not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man, the tax collector, went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. The one who humbles himself will be exalted. That we can't deal with our sin through our efforts. And so what's the good news about Christianity? The good news about Christianity is Jesus. Because Jesus is the answer to our problem of sin. Because He's the perfect, infinite one on whom you can base your identity. Other things that we base our identity on will inevitably disappoint us. Because they're flawed, just like we're flawed. You know who isn't flawed? Jesus isn't flawed. He's able to bear that weight. These other things weren't designed for us to build our lives on, but Jesus was designed for this. And so He is someone we can center our lives on. And He is one who will satisfy you when you live for Him. Because He's not going to disappoint you. You're not going to find in Him that somehow He's lacking, because that's what our longing is designed for. Our longing is pointed toward Jesus Christ. But what happens when we fail? Because in our religious mindset, when we fail, now all we have is guilt, but no hope. And when we succeed, we have confidence, but no humility. But with Jesus Christ, we have confidence not in ourselves, but in Him. And when we fail, we don't have to live with guilt, because He deals with our failures through His death on the cross, that He paid for our sin. And He demonstrated for us what it means to truly love. What it means so that we won't have to demonize those who are against us. Because when we live for other things, other people threaten what we live for. And so now we have to demonize them. But when we live for Christ, nothing can threaten Christ. And so we don't have to be threatened by other people. Instead, we can love them just like Christ loves them. But the good news about Christianity is Jesus. That other religions teach the way, but Jesus showed and was the way. And He offers salvation by grace. I love how Tim Keller describes the reality of the gospel. This is from The Reason for God. The Christian gospel is that I am so flawed that Jesus had to die for me. And that's something we don't like to admit. We don't like to admit that we're flawed, but the reality of the gospel is we are horribly flawed. So flawed that Jesus had to die for us. Yet I'm so loved and valued that Jesus was glad to die for me. And I cannot feel superior to anyone, and yet I have nothing to prove to anyone. This is the good news of the gospel. As Paul points out in 1 Corinthians 15, by the grace of God I am what I am. And His grace to me was not without effect. No, I worked harder than all of them, yet not I, but the grace of God that was with me. Or Titus 3:5 says, He saved us not because of works done by us in righteousness, but according to His own mercy. This is the good news of Christianity. At this point in time, you might be saying, yeah, that sounds great. But it's not true. It just can't be true. Because no one really thinks Christianity is true anymore. And that's great wishful thinking, but we don't buy that in our day. So, where do we go from here? And I think where we need to go from here is we need to reconsider faith and doubt. In our day, faith is usually pitted against what? Some people have faith, and other people have what? Reason. So if you're a Christian, you have faith. But other people, they have reason. And the people who doubt Christianity are saying, I don't have faith. I'm using reason, and that's why I'm skeptical of Christianity. But here's the reality. The reality is, everyone has faith. And I want to begin, before we tease that out a bit more, just to encourage you as if you are a believer, for you to not just kind of say, well, I'm just going to believe, and I'm not going to use my mind, and people may bring up objections, or maybe I even have some doubts. I'm just going to kind of suppress that and just say, well, I'm just going to kind of believe. And I'm going to exercise what people in our day say is a blind faith. But I think it's good for us as believers to really wrestle with doubts. Potentially the doubts that you may be thinking through. That maybe you grew up being taught certain things, and now maybe you're at school and you're hearing people pushing back and you're beginning to wonder about it. And I say, hey, let's begin to think through these things. Don't just push them aside. Because potentially what happens is eventually just they build up so much that you just say, okay, I'll just forget Christianity. Whereas if potentially if you'd wrestled through them, you could have found some good answers with those. But also, because you hopefully have friends and neighbors and relatives who have doubts about Christianity. And you want to really wrestle with those so that you understand where they're coming from. So that you can effectively try to communicate with them about what Christianity says. But perhaps you're here, and you're someone who doesn't believe. So you'd say, I have doubts, or I'm skeptical of Christianity. And to you, I want you to understand that your doubts are actually a set of alternate beliefs. There's a phrase that's used in philosophy called defeater beliefs. And defeater beliefs are this. You say, I don't believe this. And the reason you don't believe this is actually because you believe this. And this belief makes it so that you can't believe this belief. At least not rationally. So, it's a dumb example, right? If you say, you know, I think that that's not a good example. Let me switch it. Let's say I tell you all that I drive a Ferrari. Now, some of you might believe that. Others of you might say, you know, I know people who are pastors, And it's very rare for a pastor to be able to drive a Ferrari. And so you would say, I don't think you drive a Ferrari, though. And the reason you think that is because you believe pastors don't tend to make money, enough money to drive a Ferrari. And so this belief makes it so that you won't accept this belief. Right? Do you understand how that works? So in Christianity, what typically tends to happen is certain people have beliefs, and so they hear what Christianity has to say, and they don't believe it, but they don't believe it because of this belief over here. Now, what we don't tend to realize is that we have this belief over here. That if I just said I drove a Ferrari, you might say, I don't believe it. But if I asked you why, you may not be able to say, well, this is why. So, let me just give a couple of examples here. Right? Let's say, like I mentioned earlier, Genesis 1, God created the world. And you might say, I don't believe that. Or a lot of people in the world might say, I don't believe that. You say, well, why don't they believe that? And the reason they don't believe it is because they have this belief. Everything in the world is the result of evolutionary processes. Now, if everything in the world is the result of evolutionary processes, you know what isn't true? That God created the world. And the reverse is true as well. If you really believe God created the world, you know what you don't believe? Everything is the result of evolutionary processes, right? They defeat each other. Or this. Truth is just culturally determined. Truth is something that's just it's just a matter of culture. Now, if you believe that, you know what you don't believe? That Christianity is actually a true religion for all people. Because those are incompatible beliefs. And what I want us to try to recognize tonight, and then Lord willing, over the next two sessions, is to try to surface at least some of the beliefs over here. Because usually when we interact about Christianity, what happens is this. Maybe you're a Christian and you'll say something like, I think God made the world. And then the person pushes back and says, well, defend that belief. And so then you're trying to defend that belief. And so you tend to be on the defensive, and so you put this belief out, and now we're saying, okay, let's evaluate this belief of Christianity. But you know what doesn't usually happen? Well, let's evaluate this belief that's causing you to doubt Christianity. Because most of the time, if we put this belief to the same amount of scrutiny as this belief, this one falls apart. But we don't do that. We just kind of stay over here and are continually fighting over here. And so I want to begin to try to bring up these alternate beliefs and to really think through them. And so if you're someone who's skeptical about Christianity, you need to consider what you believe, and you need to scrutinize it the same way you want Christians to scrutinize their beliefs. And if you're a Christian, you need to begin to be able to discern what people are saying over here so that you can help them to really think through this belief over here. And I think this will be helpful on at least two levels. On the most basic level, it'll be helpful in this way. That we'll be able to move past name-calling to actual disagreement. That most oftentimes in our culture, we never actually get to really disagreeing because we don't really understand where the other person is. And so we want to be able to really understand the two different ideas out there so that then we can actually say, okay, I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, and this is where I disagree. Not just, well, you're a bigot, or you're an idiot, or you're just intolerant. Those aren't arguments. Those are name calls. But I hope, actually, that something else will happen as well. That I hope that if you are a believer, that as you work through this, that you'll be strengthened in your faith. You'll have greater confidence because now you'll understand, you know what, this objection this person brought up doesn't actually hold water. Whereas the truth of Christianity makes sense. And if you're someone right now who's skeptical about Christianity, I hope that perhaps through this time that you'd begin to say, well, maybe I never really considered what Christianity has to say after all. That I didn't even want to listen to it. Because I had this belief over here that actually isn't very solid. That it's not reason versus faith. It's faith versus faith. And this faith is a blind faith.